Welcome to It's Bloody Complicated, the Compass podcast that brings you conversations from across the progressive movement. During the show, we speak with writers, thinkers, politicians, journalists, and campaigners about how we come out of these unprecedented times in much better shape than we went in. I'm Frances Foley, your host today and Deputy Director of Compass. Compass is a place where people come together to create the visions, alliances, and actions to be the change we wish to see in the world. We're interested in the how of political change as much as the what, and we think conversations like these are a great place to start. Compass members can join the call live and can put their own questions directly to our guests. If you'd like to be part of it, go to action.compassonline.org.uk/podcast to join Compass today. Otherwise, sit back, grab your drink of choice, and get ready to get complicated. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of It's Bloody Complicated. I'm your host this evening, Frances. I'm Deputy Director here at Compass. And tonight's episode, we're going to delve into one of my favourite subjects of all time, and feeling slightly ashamed that this is maybe one of our first episodes about this. But we're going to dig deep into the subject of citizen assemblies and all things participatory and deliberative, which I'm getting those out early because they're hard words to say. So firstly, I would like to welcome two of my amazing compadres, wonderful friends and allies in the democracy movement. I'm really excited to have you both on tonight. And we always kick off with the classic starter question. Where are you and how are you? And we'll start with you, Jamie.
Okay, hello everyone. So where am I? I'm in East London in my council flat. I've lived here 25 years with two very dodgy but brilliant poets. And I'm conscious of the fact that all my world belongings are in this room. So my underwear is over there, for God's sake. So don't look too closely. How am I doing? Busy. This is great work. And 2024 is going to see nearly two thirds of the whole world voting. And that's pretty spooky. And we've got great work to do. So it's wonderful to be here. Thank you very much, Frances.
Amazing. Thank you, Jamie. And I'm just definitely peering much more closely than I did. So encouraging viewers to, engage with Jamie's backdrop. James, where are you? Your backdrop is absolutely beautiful. not a pant in sight.
Good
a
evening.
Plant, but not a pant.
I had a little clear up, actually, before I came on. Just so that, I didn't have to compete with Jamie's underwear game. But I'm calling in from Folkestone. I'm okay, yeah. We were chatting a little bit before we came on that I feel a bit like I'm on a toboggan going down a chute. I'm still surviving. I'm still making it down, so I'm good.
Okay, we're going to delve into that particularly arresting image probably sometime over the course of this hour because you are both very busy people, yeah, and I've got a lot going on. So once again, thanks for making the time to be here. It is great to have you both on. So, to hear a little bit about who you both are and what you're both up to, I wonder if you both could give me a quick 2-minute pitch to your kind of labours of love. Jamie, why don't you start by telling us a little bit about the Global Assembly? And also, if you can, in 2 minutes, say how you came to work at Global Assembly, because I think your trajectory is interesting on this one. And also, James, you too. How did you come to work on the House of Citizens campaign and work at Sortition Foundation? And can you tell us in, if you can, 2 minutes, what these projects do? Start with you, Jamie.
Sure. And I'm going to keep it at 2 minutes. So ordinary middle-class white guy, you might have noticed, middle-class, middle-aged guy now. But when I was 18, I was on holiday in taking that year off, which, privileged people do. I ended up being in a country where I had a gun put to my head for taking photographs of soldiers shooting at children. At that moment, as the muzzle was right between my eyes and they made me pull the film out, I realised it's just a roll of the dice that I was born in Bromley and not in this town. And so I've been an activist ever since then. I was hugely involved in Occupy, before then Reclaim the Streets, and also Climate Camp. And then I got very involved in Extinction Rebellion after Occupy. I've been everywhere, really, in all of those grassroots movements, including community organising as well. I guess one of the big moments for me was when I was doing Occupy and we had participatory democracy assemblies every day, upwards of 3,000 people outside St Paul's Cathedral. And you have 2 minutes on the mic, like I do now, actually. And it didn't matter who you were. So, Julian Assange got 2 minutes. Everybody got 2 minutes. And every day, two assemblies a day, every day, every assembly, I learned the same thing. You'd have a very confident, educated person, privileged, generally bloke, but not always. They'd take the mic and they'd make some very good points about Deleuze and stuff I didn't have a clue about, right? And you know, quite a lot of hands went, hurrah, good point, well made. And then you'd have someone who takes the mic and she has a Lambert and Butler in one hand and the mic in the other, and she starts by saying, I am effing terrified, but I just feel like I've got to say this. And so I learnt the power of those without agency getting agency. That sounds cheesy, but it's the truth, that the power is in when people without agency are heard. And so when I got involved in Extinction Rebellion, they were very interesting because they're talking about citizens' assemblies. I thought to myself, there has to be a global assembly. I got very lucky and met two absolute pioneers in the field who work with ISWE now, I-S-W-E. And we ran the world's first ever global citizens' assembly, chosen by Sortition in 2021. I think a bell just went off in my head, but that's probably around about 2 minutes. But it changed our lives being involved in it. We're a beautiful species capable of extraordinary things. And it's a very moving thing we're talking about today. This is about humanity. It's not about smarty pants politics stuff at all. This is about all of us.
Amazing. Brilliant. Inspiring stuff. James, can you follow that? Actually, very good. 2 minutes, which has managed to concentrate quite a lot into those 2 minutes. Over to you.
Well, in the spirit of sort of citizens' assemblies, it was not about competing with that, but maybe complementing that or offering a different perspective. But basically, Sortition Foundation exists to build a movement for powerful and permanent citizens' assemblies. And the two main ways it does that are by doing the selection process, so the actual sortition process, for a whole bunch of, you know, all over the world, local citizens' assemblies and councils, right the way up to, as Jamie mentioned, like contributing to the global assembly at COP26. And then using the money to then campaign to institutionalize these things, so that people from all walks of life get to make decisions about how we live together on Earth, basically, rather than a very small number of people whose interests are consistently overly represented, producing a whole series of problems which we're experiencing right now. And so how did I get into that? It's interesting. I've only just realized, as I've been sat here looking at your face, Jamie, that actually we have a lot in common, but one of the things is we both worked at New Internationalist, but I don't think at the same time, which is a independent media cooperative. And I was there in about 2007, so it's before the financial crisis, before the sort of student movement was on the rise in 2010. And one of the questions that I had, and one of the things that, I mean, New International is a brilliant organization. It really teaches you about the world through the eyes of the people in those countries, rather than sort of British journalists writing about what's going on. And one of the things I learned is how important students were to, you know, getting good stuff done. And I was like, why isn't this going on in the UK, basically? Like, why aren't students in the UK like they are in other countries at the forefront of change? And so I took a job in Leeds Student Union, which was the biggest, I think, in the country at the time. It had 32,000 members. And one of the answers to that I found was that student union was replicating the same political structures and dynamics that young people don't tend to engage in, basically. And I was like, why on earth is this happening? And so we established Leeds as the first union to use student assemblies to make decisions, where it brought ordinary students together who listened to different points of view of other representatives and then made a sort of informed decision. And that's just sort of changed what I sort of thought was possible, basically. Because I was like, well, if we can do it for 32,000 people, that's not that smaller than a constituency. Why can't we do this at scale, if you know what I mean? And so, and then since then, I've worked with a whole bunch of different movements and issues through different. I'm an associate at NEON and PERC, who support different groups fighting for different sort of social and environmental justice. But one of the things that they all have in common is that the way that we make decisions, you know, arguably is just not capable of actually giving us the solutions we need. And so that's what brings me sort of full circle to work back on Sortition again, because it's one of the things that all of us share is a barrier to the future that we not want, but actually need to survive on the earth.
Brilliant. Very complimentary. Perfectly dovetailed. I was almost like you guys have practiced this before. Brilliant. I think where that leads me is to this question of why both of you also, you have sort of similar but also different trajectories, and you've both alighted on this question at assemblies. And I'm sort of going to go out on a limb here and suggest that actually quite a lot of people on the call don't need to be convinced that citizen assemblies are generally a good thing. But what I'm particularly interested to hear from both of you, and maybe you can bring in some personal side of this, even, you know, an experience that you want to share or a moment that kind of stood out to you, because I certainly have a couple of mine, about what particularly gets you going about citizen assemblies. Why does it sort of inject you with that energy and maybe kind of optimism that you think is necessary? We'll come to in a second any questions or doubts or, you know, caveats to that. But just, you know, if you had to say to someone and you really didn't have very long, this is what gets me excited at a certain assembly, that maybe is sometimes overlooked when people talk about it in quite a sort of nerdy or procedural way, which we all have to sometimes, but that's not what I'm looking for here. You first, James. What kind of gets you all excited and hit up about a certain assembly?
I think, quite honestly, right now we are in a situation as a country where it's like we have such a, I mean, people on the call will know this, we have such a deficit of trust in the political institutions that, you know, there's a real risk of this country becoming ungovernable, of the increased the far right becoming more and more popular. And I think right now we have a choice between continuing to rely solely on elected politicians or bringing together different people with different experiences and giving them difficult questions to grapple with and asking them to come up with the right solutions. And, like, you know, I think if you go out onto the street, which I do, and we do at Sortition Foundation a lot anyway, and ask them, look, who do you trust to make a decision in your best interest? Is it a group of politicians or a group of ordinary people? Everyone says ordinary people, like everyone. And it doesn't matter what their politics are, whether they, whoever they vote for, you know. And, like, unless we trust that people make decisions in our interests, that they, you know, that they can, they're moral people who will do right by us and they've got our backs, I think everything just crumbles, basically. And I know it sounds very sort of doomy, but it feels like everything is crumbling, doesn't it? A lot of the time, basically. And so this just feels like the way out of that crumbling and the way to rebuild. And the other thing I suppose I say is, look, it's been 858 years since King Henry II first introduced juries into English law. Like, it's time to finish the job. Do you know what I mean? Like, he trusted ordinary people to make decisions that are difficult. Like, we've got a kind of feudal hangover in the House of Lords. Let's get rid of that and, you know, let the people decide.
Amazing. I think what we're speaking to there is also this thing about it being foundational, right? So the fact that we would choose to invest in the foundations, if everything else is crumbling, you know, architecture tells you to look at the foundations of whatever it is. And I think your point about trust there is really well made. And this question about how you go in the right direction, you know, whatever, I think whatever citizen assemblies is encouraging is the right stuff that we need anyway.
Yeah.
So even if it doesn't solve every single problem in, you know, in one go, it's pushing, I'm a directionalist rather than a destinationalist on this. And that, like, it's going in the right direction. All the things that citizen assemblies feed and encourage and spark and, like, grow are the things we want to do anyway. Jamie, how about you?
Yeah, I think what you were just saying there, Francis, is brilliant, actually. And I think it's really important. What language it is, but I'm a directionalist, not a destinationalist. I didn't think I'd be saying that today, but that's, I think it's a really important part of it. I'm not a intellectual and academic. I'm not a practitioner. I'm solely grassroots. But I've been through a very emotional experience by being involved in these processes. And one of the things that I've learned from pioneers, in my estimation, is, look, it's important to have humility about this. It's this far off the ground. It's already better than a system that is clearly going to kill us if you're taking climate change and the rise of far right, which we're going to see this year. And so that humility is very important. Having said that, I think for me personally, when you asked that question originally, it's what I said about Occupy, I realise we've got it so wrong. To think that people who come generally from a very specific privileged background have the wealth of information and wisdom on the life of the 99% is just embarrassing. And the wisdom of the crowd is a really important phrase. I would go to assemblies. These are participatory democracy assemblies in Occupy, and I'd look at what the assembly would be about and go, well, I know what I think about this, and then learn how wrong I was.
Yeah.
By listening to everyone else, you know, take a corny example, well, a painful example, all the people out there tonight who are going to be choosing between heating or eating. They're the people who would be quite informative and useful if you're going to think about what are we going to do about how we work with the energy companies in this country, the big six. Okay, I want to listen to people who are actually experiencing life in a very precarious way every day. I want to hear about their lives and their lives being given the opportunity to inform about how we should all be living together. As James touched on, one of the things you find out with sortition shows and assemblies is people have the well-being of all as their natural default, all right? I mean, what I found profoundly moving in the Global Assembly was I was an observer on these Zooms, because it was during COVID in 2021, right? And so I'm sitting there watching a breakout room, and I have a goat herder from Socotra, which is a really remote island off Yemen, and a 19-year-old student from Wuhan, and an elderly seamstress from Brazil, and a young farmer from Congo, okay? And they have translators and note takers. It's a very complex thing, and all power to the process experts who put it together, which is people like Claire Mellier and Rich Wilson. And luckily, because I was an observer, I had the camera and the microphone turned off, and it's lucky because I'm sorry to say to everybody, but I wept like I sobbed. And I sobbed because I felt very strongly, this is the default mode for this species. It's literally compassion, a willingness to cooperate immediately, and a desire for our children to live safely. The whole world, I mean, it's only 100 people, so it's a tiny, tiny drop. But we did proper sortition to establish that 100. And every breakout room I went to, that was redolent from beginning to end. These people, can you imagine what it's like for them? You know, you're a forester in Thailand. You only come down every couple of months from the forest to the town, and a student approaches you. You've never had any education at all. 10% had no formal education, 70% living on $10 or less a day, you know, 13% white. It was the human family. It was a good snapshot. You know, if you're Chom, the forester, and suddenly you're meeting the human family, that's what they were all doing. Nothing like that's ever happened before. And I saw time and time again, our default mode is compassion. Our default mode is I'm willing to cooperate. And our default mode is all I wish is for my children to be safe. These, if you see the decision makers of the future coming from that place, that expertise, which is the expertise of being a just ordinary human being, then you have something that gives us a little chink of, I wouldn't dare use the word hope, but a faith. I have faith in humanity because of these experiences. Yeah. So that's what gets me out of bed in the morning. Bear in mind, I've been an activist since 1981. It's not a good thing to have done. It's been extremely painful to watch what's happened, to be outside different COP climate conferences, screaming, able to choose to discern the difference between Italian tear gas and French tear gas and Danish tear gas. And then you find something like this, and it gives me faith in humanity. And that's why I get up in the morning and come across as quite chirpy.
Yeah, mostly, actually. I think faith is that really beautiful word. And weirdly enough, that's actually what I say when I'm asked this question, is the fact that it seems to grow people's faith, democratic faith, in the true meaning of democratic, i.e. faith in one another and people's best interests and abilities and expertise and knowledge and, you know, willingness, all of this stuff. That's what we need to actually be building, right? Not faith in this abstract idea of democracy, but yeah, in one another, which is something that came across so clearly in what you both said.
Can I just add, Francis, that I think it's the other place that I've seen that is in community organising, because I actually think that both community organising and citizens' assemblies both have at their root, which is something that I like listening to you speak, Jamie, like, I definitely noticed that I have reflecting while I'm reflecting listening to you is like basically a love for people. Like that is what you have to do. Like you have to love people, and you have to also believe in their capacity and wisdom to do amazing things. And like, if you don't have those two things, you're not going to do community organizing. Do you know what I mean? But you're also probably not going to run citizens assemblies. And like that, because like that's the thing that you believe. That's the thing that you believe in. Do you know what I mean? And then the other thing I'd say that, like, listening to you speak, that really resonated with me with that thing about compassion, because I often think of compassion as like love and suffering together. Like, to be compassionate, you have to like show up for people and sit sometimes in their pain. And I think that is true in like citizens assembly. It's not like they're easy. Do you know what I mean? Like, they are really tough conversations. Like, to actually really hear someone, not only what someone believes, but why they believe it, and to actually like take the time to empathize with that, that's really hard work, basically. And to sit in the discomfort of that is requires, I think, the same thing, sort of like love and suffering in a way. So I think
that's absolutely true, but to go from the sublime to ridiculous, they're also really often so tedious. In the sense of, and that's work too, right? I think people always talk about these big moments where they're dealing with these big ethical questions and people look at each other across divides. And I've seen that happen in the room, but often actually in the strangest of circumstances, when you'd be talking about town planning in Dudley, which was one of the symptoms, that, you know, it brings up actually really nothing is, you know, nothing escapes people's sort of moral and ethical consideration. So they're always bringing that in. But actually some of the stuff that you have to go through to cast those sorts of judgments or to make reach those collective decisions rather is actually quite dull and procedural and difficult and detailed. And I think that is really great too, because that builds everyone's muscle for dealing with the real stuff, right? Then you know you're actually getting into it. You're not being asked what's some, you know, by a focus group moderator, what's some really off top of the head opinion on this huge issue. You're being asked to get right into the dirt and like dig around in there. And people know when they're being asked meaningful stuff, and then they do it, even if it's really tough. I want to come on to, I mean, we could all sit here for an hour and talk about how amazing the assemblies are. I'm easily could do that. Firstly, I'd like to encourage people to put questions in the Q&A. We've got lots of questions happening in the chat, lots of chat happening in the chat. But please put questions to James and Jamie, who are experts and also just wonderful people about certain assemblies. Even if you're someone who's an advocate of certain assemblies, what do you find difficult in terms of what other people ask you? Do people bring up things which you think you find it difficult to respond to? And this is what I wanted to touch on both of you now. What do you think is sort of the best argument against certain assemblies you've ever heard? And how do you usually respond to that? Jamie, we'll come to you.
Yeah, the best arguments against certain assemblies are pretty good arguments. And one of the areas I hope we surface tonight is it's a very precarious moment for these new processes, because I believe that there are lots of companies and organizations and advocates who are jumping on it with the same mindset of the power structures that have brought us into this troublesome time, you know, and so making money and cutting corners and making a name for yourself and all those things, that's happening. And so one of the ways that that's done, which I think is a very specific problem with citizen assemblies, is the basic question, who chooses the experts? So the governance of the process is fundamental. I don't think, I'm not an academic, but I now work with pioneers, but I think there's very, very, very few assemblies that have happened in the world that were independent and that had the highest level of integrity in the governance of the process. And this is dangerous because an ordinary member of the public could be quite interested in this, but if they keep happening and the process is weak, it doesn't bring in important issues that would have expanded the possibilities of what's going to happen, I will eventually get turned off. And also, if I continually see global citizens assemblies that just come, they have no impact, and so they just come across as a very expensive focus group, then I'll lose interest. So I think it's really important. I mean, I have all faith in Sortition Foundation. I know Brett really well. I know where they've come from. He started talking about it to me in 2015 when we were doing Occupy Democracy. And I was going, what's this guy? That'll never work. What's he talking about? And it's actually genius. I think he's a genius, literally. And I think that there's a
he's all right.
But there's a body of pioneers who have that high desire for proper independence and proper integrity. And then there's a widening circus the whole time of people jumping on a bandwagon and going, it's the silver bullet. And that brings me back to the original point. They are this far off the ground. There is a handful of people who understand how to deepen the integrity of the process and achieve independence. And if we don't pay attention to that and go down this silver bullet or sort everything out, we're in trouble.
I mean, James, I basically, not surprisingly, agree with everything you said. I think the thing I want to pick up on is, it actually links back to something I talked about before around trust, but something that's very close to trust is fatalism. So I think probably one of the biggest challenges to getting the future we need through mass public participation in democratic processes is like, the feeling that nothing will change, so what's the point, right? Like, I can either get off, this sofa is quite comfy and Traitors is quite interesting and maybe I'll just watch this rather than, you know what I mean?
I'm just going to say to you, as a facilitator of certain assemblies, there were times in Traitors I thought, I could facilitate much
don't
better.
Don't get me wrong, I'm sympathetic to that stuff.
We haven't heard from that faithful there, not that I know that they're faithful. Sorry, there was there was a weird melange there that could happen, right? Anyway.
We'll riff on that later.
Just
anyway.
Small point on that. People love watching people sit in a room and try to make a decision. that's reality TV and it's drama. But actually, it's people just sitting around a table trying to pick a decision. It, 12 Angry Men, one of the most famous and successful films of all time, just about people trying to make a decision. It's fascinating.
Yeah, there's nothing more normal than a group of people with no stated person in charge working out what their shared interest is. I mean, like, probably the most common way that we relate to other people is friendship. We probably have more friends than family. When you're friends with people, that's what you do. You work out what your shared interest is and you try and make a decision in your shared interest without sort of authority. You gather information, you know. We're already using this mode of making decisions all the time. It's just about scaling it up. But the thing I was going to say is about citizens' assemblies that is my main worry is when, which Jamie spoke to, but I just want to underline, is like basically when, as you say, they invest in this big process and then these people take real time out of their lives, which is really disruptive to their lives, and go through this process that, as I said, requires compassion and energy. And then they produce these recommendations, which are, based on the consideration of experts in the field. And then they go to the political class and the political class do literally nothing with them. And then the people who participate in it were like, well, what the hell was the point in that? Everyone else was like, well, they are pointless, aren't they? Like, because the politicians aren't going to do what they said anyway, which is basically most of why people are so at the end of their tether with politicians, because they say one thing and do another. And so it just reinforces this sense that there's nothing you can do and we may as well stay at home, basically. And that is really damaging. But I also think it's really damaging. It's not smart for politicians either, because look at what happened in France. Look at what's just happened in, I mean, it's quite early to tell exactly what's happened in Ireland, but with Macron, with the climate assembly, he promised to implement the recommendations. He then U-turned and then it all kicked off. Do you know what I mean? And then the same with the Irish Citizens Assembly we've had just now on the constitution, they ignored the recommendation of the Citizens Assembly and then the Irish people voted against their recommendation. The Irish government lost that referendum. Why? Because ultimately trust is a two-way street. And so if you don't trust the people, they're not going to trust you back, basically. And that is the real problem. That is a real problem. And that's precisely why we have to institutionalize them so that they can't be ignored. Because otherwise I genuinely believe it can do more damage than good, basically.
That's really important to hear you both saying that, and I think you're clearly both very alive to those risks and those considerations, but also have solutions. There are answers to these problems. And we've seen good examples of how people can respond, especially representatives. So I want to ask one more question, just as a shout out. We have some good questions coming up in the Q&A. Please keep them coming in. You know, what do you find difficult about communicating about citizen assemblies? What doubts and concerns do you honestly have? Bear it all. You know, James bared his underpants. You can bare your soul regarding citizen assemblies. So my question is, bring it right up to date. And so obviously a few weeks ago, we had this, as ever, slightly chaotic announcement from Labour. Announcement? Question mark? Suggestion, proposal, dipping toe in the water might be the most diplomatic way of putting it. And Sue Gray, who's obviously Starmer's chief of staff, I think is her title at the moment, you know, said, interestingly, she might be interested in considering certain assemblies to look at. And I think the subjects that she name-checked were House of Lords reform, devolution, and house building. But it's particularly this quote that I found interesting, given what you were both just saying. She said, she warned that the civil service won't like this because they'll have no control. Now, as someone who's worked for a long time in the civil service, I thought she was quite brave to say that. And I was applauding her in that moment. But particularly I'm interested in, you know, maybe shifting tack slightly. And rather than trying to kind of proclaim the importance of citizen assemblies to the public or to kind of move people on this idea, a lot of whom is, as you say, James, if you ask them about it, are kind of instinctively interested and intrigued and then often positive about it. How would you, if you do, sort of sell this into sceptics who may be part of the government or have been part of political parties? You know, I often say that all citizen assembly people have to down their drink when someone says we have a citizen assembly, it's called parliament. But that is something we hear very, very often.
Yeah.
How have you found it's worked to convince people who are sceptical, who have been within representative democracy, quite well entrenched within representative democracy? Let's come to you, Jamie, and then to James, and then I'll take some questions from the floor.
Sure. I'm not one for quoting politicians, but actually I think this is really useful. Jean-Claude Juncker, when he said, we all know what to do, but we don't know how to do it and get re-elected. So I'm sort of, so for me, it's like I said at the beginning, and I think it's important. It's not like a sort of false modesty. I think it's really valuable that I'm not an intellectual, that I'm not an academic, and I've worked in grassroots for over three decades, right? So one thing that strikes me profoundly is very few people know about these. And if they do, they read about it in The Guardian or in The Economist or... This has to arrive in people's lives through popular culture. And so what that means is you want people in Senegal doing a hip hop song about it. You want a YouTube vlogger in Mumbai vlogging about it. You know, this country, we have a large artist collective called Hard Art, and we are working with artists to bring this into people's lives through popular culture. Right? I'm making a film about the Global Assembly called One World or None. And we're working on a couple of TV shows. Check this out, right? Situation comedy. So we're working with these comedy writers and they're going, this will make a great situation comedy. I've got, what, a citizens assembly chosen by sortition. They went, situation comedy is unusual people brought together in unusual circumstances. So one really important job is for us to actually break through just having a podcast in Compass, which is, I'm honoured and I'm delighted to be here. But I want this to be arriving in people's lives in all kinds of different ways that are popular, to do with popular culture. And I think that what Jean-Claude Juncker is implying with his famous quote is really valuable, because if you have a critical mass, to what used for, you know, old activist phrase, if you have a critical mass of the public going, hold on, I understand this, this is great, and I want this, then you can see politicians recognising the fact that this is not a niche thing belonging to the progressive left. This is actually the people wanting this. And if you set it up in the right way, so advocacy is something that I think is really interesting around this. If you set it up as advocating for it with a politician and you've done it right, it's very difficult for the politician to go, no, this is a load of rubbish, because the politician is, as long as it's got independence and integrity, the politician is literally saying, I don't trust the people. So, you know, the best description I've had is by a really interesting intellectual in Australia, and I really like him because he's really funny. He said, look, you're a POM. You know the double bouncer. I don't know what it is. I don't know about cricket. But there's a ball that you chuck and it bounces straight up, going straight to your chest, and you can't help but deflect, right? And then you get caught. He said, you deliver a citizen assembly. It's got to be independent. You deliver a citizen assembly like that, so the politician has to respond, right? And then he said, then it's that famous scene from When Harry Met Sally. In other words, you need to bring it into the public's consciousness in a way where they go, I want what she's having. I'm assuming everyone remembers that bit in the film where Meg Ryan fakes an orgasm in such a loud way in a restaurant, right, to kind of let Harry know that she was faking so many orgasms. And it's really loud. The whole restaurant's shocked.
And that immediately reminded me of the last episode that I facilitated.
And then the waiter goes over to this elderly lady and says, what are you having? And she says, I'll have what she's having. And it's, so it's create that I'll have what she's having moment. It's that's the way through for me. I don't think it's got to do with being associated with the left or the right or intellectuals or any of that stuff, NGOs. It's not there where the work is at all, in my opinion.
Brilliant. Anything you briefly want to add on that, James? Then we're
going
to launch over to the people on the call.
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly true in our polling that this isn't something that is, you know, supported disproportionately by the right or the left. In fact, we find that Leave voters are more supportive of it than Remain voters. It tends to be whether you basically have fairly elitist values or you believe more in the capacity and wisdom of ordinary people. I think to sort of get into your question, I'll try and be very brief in terms of like, what would I say to the Labour Party? I mean, I haven't mentioned it much and I probably should, as it's our priority campaign. We're campaigning to replace the House of Lords, as I mentioned briefly, with the House of Citizens. So that's a permanent rolling citizens assembly of around 400 people. And I'll briefly say why I think that is the right answer to House of Lords reform, and then very briefly speak more broadly to why citizens assemblies more broadly are important. So firstly, like, politicians have been trying to get an elected Lords for over 100 years and they can't get it. Everyone thinks that the Lords block it. Actually, most of the proposals have never made it out of the Commons. Why have they never made it out of the Commons? Because if you elect a second chamber, basically everyone's like, no, that threatens the primacy of the Commons. We're not having that. You know what I mean? House of Citizens, A, you've never tried it. And B, like, it's complementary to an elected chamber, right? It's not competing with it. So that's thing one. Second thing is, what we find is people actually like some of the expertise that's in the Lords. They actually don't want the kind of partisan aspect of it. They do want the expertise. If you have a House of Citizens, because every citizens assembly brings in experts on the field and they're kind of on tap but not on top, right? Then that means you don't lose the expertise, but you do lose, you know, the sort of nepotism and corruption that we've seen happening with like Michelle Moan and the like, right? Next thing is, if you go with a regional option, well, then, you know, basically you've just got a massive England block. And so who the hell wants that if you're in Scotland or anywhere else? And then, you know, ultimately, I know we have a weird thing about tradition in this country. So if you want to give, you know, some of them, like some sort of ceremonial role, then great, basically. Like, they don't even have to get rid of them all. They can just let them step aside and actually let the people decide through, like, informed deliberation, right? And so we've worked out how this will work. We've done we've designed the process. But then, so, like, basically what I want to say is, I actually think that on House of Lords reform, Citizens Assembly is the only thing that will work. And to try the same thing that you've tried for the last 100 years time and time again and to expect a different result is, you know, definition of insanity. And I think the more broad point, and then I'll finish, is that citizens assemblies have a track record of getting hard stuff done. And if Labour get into power, they have got a fair amount of hard stuff to get done, right? So what are you going to, you know, from a very instrumental point of view, what are you going to use to do that? You know what I mean? You know, how did they resolve the debate around abortion in Ireland? They used a citizens' assembly. So as long as you actually then listen to the recommendation of it, then your referendum will probably go your way. Do you know what I mean? So I think there is an instrumental sort of utilitarian argument for this. And it also doesn't cost anything to do like constitutional reform. Yeah, it takes political power, but it's not like building a high-speed railway. Do you know what I mean? So if you're worried about cash, you can get massive gains without spending a penny, and you can show that you actually trust the people, and through that they'll start to trust you again.
Fantastic. Brilliant. If you're not convinced after that, guys, you won't be. No, you might be. Just give it some time.
Hello, Samuel here from the Compass office. I hope you're enjoying the discussion so far. It's Bloody Complicated is brought to you by Compass, and it's made possible by the support of our amazing members, like Eliza. Here's Eliza on why she joined the Compass community.
My name is Eliza. I've been a Compass member for about 3 or 4 years, I think. What drew me to Compass was the fact that it's cross-party and it's also not a party. I had a light bulb moment about elections, which was no one's going to win except the Tories under this system, and we have to work together. Having been previously a member of the Labour Party and then joining the Green Party, I really wanted to see parties working together, and we have people that are politicians, MPs, trade union leaders, etc. And it's quite level. There's no big hierarchy. It's quite an honest, open space where people come together. You will hear from people from all around the political spectrum actually debating the hard stuff. It's actually, let's find a solution to the problems that we have and let's do it together. We need this progressive alliance. And I would like to see people who are passionate about getting the Tories out in the next election and getting proportional representation in. Come and join Compass now and actually swell the movement, because without people, there's no power. And that's what we need right now.
Find out more about joining the Compass community at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. And now, back to the discussion.
We're going to take some questions now. We've got some juicy questions here in the Q&A. Thanks, people, for jumping in with these. These are great. Peter, have you teed up the first lineup of people to unmute themselves and ask their question?
Yes, I did. And we have two people lined up. We have Kirsten and David. So I'm going to put Kirsten first.
Excellent.
You can unmute yourself now.
Kirsten, great to see you. Do unmute yourself. Ask your question. Fire away.
Hi, yeah, great to see you too. I haven't got a camera tonight for some reason. I don't know, there's been some update going on my laptop, which obviously was a down date rather than an update, I would say.
Very good.
Right, okay. Thanks very much for some really interesting and inspirational talks, James and Jamie. Really food for thought. I have been a member of a Citizens' Assembly twice over the last 5 years, I guess. One for the EU, which was a major effort, two-day effort, and one on health and well-being for my local council. And the thing is that on both of them, they were very thorough, and we had experts talking, and it was got all organized properly, except that it seems to me that the organizers really were tempted to structure and lead the assembly through their line of questioning and the areas they questioned us on or asked us to debate. Inevitably led to a predetermined result that they wanted to see, as opposed to what people would have come up with if given a much looser structure. Even with Saltitian, somebody has to organize it, somebody has to facilitate and select the questioning or the debates. How do we get past that?
Mm. Great question, Kirsten, and amazing to hear you've been part of two.
Wow.
It could be you, and it was twice. I've got my questions now, I'm kidding. Brilliant to have you on. Thank you, Kirsten. And I think we've got David as well.
I think you've started to answer my question, but you might want to add something. It was simply this, is how do you translate love, compassion and grassroots expertise into the huge transformations that the world requires and requires very urgently.
Brilliant. Thank you, David. So let's take those two, because they were quite juicy, big questions as well. Thank you both. Why don't we come to you first, James, and then to you, Jamie, and just pick up anything you'd like from those two questions.
I feel like the second question is so Jamie Kelsey Fry that I'm not going to speak to that one and just shine a spotlight on his awesomeness. So I'll deal with the technical question. I think ultimately this is a question of power again, and I think it goes back to what I was saying in terms of what are the limitations of citizens' assemblies. And I completely agree that if you set the terms of debate and frame it in a certain way, that that is a way of steering the conversation in a particular direction. And so that's exactly why, as one of our proposals, as part of having replacing the House of Lords with the House of Citizens, part of that proposal would be that the House of Citizens can commission citizens' assemblies on specific issues of public interest and ensure that they are done in a way that doesn't basically repeat your experience, Kirsten. Because I completely agree, and I think we need democratic oversight of both the process and participation in the process, as far as I'm concerned. And there's already examples of that happening in East Belgium, where there is a permanent citizens' assembly. They do exactly that. So this is not without precedent, and that works. But I think it's also true to say, because we are, it's the old John Holloway thing of in, against, and beyond. Like, there's also stuff that we can do when we're in the current way that we're making decisions. So someone came to talk to us who took part in the future of Scotland, the Citizens' Assembly on the Future of Scotland. Must try and get my words in the right order. That's helpful on these things. And they were saying that they experienced something not a million miles from what you're saying, and actually collectively had a discussion about it and pushed back against the people running the process and asked for basically like more perspectives from people that they felt weren't represented in the debate, basically. So there is, what I'm trying to say is, there is examples of citizens collectively challenging the secretariat, I think it's called often, which is the group of people that that run the show. But I also think there is lots of ways that we can improve facilitation of these processes as well. And like, you know, as Jeremy said, it's not a silver bullet. It's human beings. There's going to be mistakes. But I think compared to what we have now, at least it doesn't sort of like hardwire in a whole bunch of stuff, which ultimately leads to some of the outcomes that we see today.
Thanks for both those questions, and just to add to what James is saying for you, Kirsten, I think it's really important what you're bringing up, and it's really unusual, unique experience to have been in two assemblies. It's what I was saying earlier, it's this far off the ground, and I have enormous respect for those practitioners, those pioneers out there, who are very clear about the amount of work that needs to be done on the governance of these processes, maintaining highest levels of integrity, highest level of independence. But also, as James just touched on, the facilitation is really important, but not in ways that people generally assume. You know, I'm working with this collective of artists on all of this called Hard Art. And just by working with artists, when they understand what's possible, they start saying, well, this is what could happen in the experience, right? So, for example, I work with an artist called Claire Patey, who runs the Empathy Museum, and she does something called A Mile in Your Shoes. Right. So what you do is you go in. So they have different themes. And she did one in Brixton recently about the riots in 1981. So you go into her space and they say, what size shoe are you? They give you a pair of shoes and then headphones, and off you go for a walk. Listen to this story for 40 minutes. You're listening to the story of the man whose shoes you're walking in, describing the experience of the 1981 riots. So what I'm getting at is, we haven't even begun to open up on such an important area, which is how can you enrich the experience of the assembly members? So it's not just learning facts and statistics and researches and graphs, but the human element of the story. Mm. There's all these ways to make it more powerful. But to speak to what you're bringing up, David, which is so important, because it's so easy to say, you know, our default mode is compassion. But how does that translate into change that is consummate with what we're facing with climate collapse? And I, from the experiences that I've had, what I believe is that you're going to have these two things happening at the same time. There's going to be a real panic. There is in much of the world, but there's going to be much more panic in the West and in Europe as we recognize that this is irreversible change. There's, you know, extreme weather is the new normal. And at the same time as this kind of panic rising or consciousness rising, which is what we're trying to do with Extinction Rebellion and people like Just Stop Oil, there's going to be an opportunity for people to say, you know what, there's a better way by which we make decisions. So, you know, as a climate activist, my conclusion came, I came to the conclusion, you cannot deal with the climate crisis until you deal with the crisis in democracy. That's why my focus is completely in this now. And I believe that when when you reach what you could call a critical mass of people who recognize there is this better way of making decisions, and every time the decisions are really, they're not influenced by lobbyists, they're not influenced by someone trying to keep power, they're not influenced by any of the constrictions that politicians have, inevitably their conclusions, their decisions are way more centered around just ordinary well-being of people. So when we did the Global Assembly, it was a no-brainer. The kind of conclusions that the people came to in their declaration, for them it was obvious. You've got to believe, you've got to realize, right, a lot of the people in the Global Assembly, when they learnt about climate science, lots of them went, oh, I thought it was God. You know, we have Farhat Parveen in Pakistan, in her village, on film, and she's saying, until I did the Global Assembly, we thought that the floods were our sins and wrongdoings, but now I know that it's not. And for many of these Assembly members, the penny drops about what climate change is, the penny drops about why it's happening, the penny drops about what we need to stop it or to ameliorate it to some extent. And then the next stage is, well, why aren't we doing it? And I think there's this common sense thread. Once you start seeing this as an alternative or parallel decision-making body, then you get an opportunity for people to not like smash the government, but to actually get behind this wave of support for, look, you know, you can't make the decisions we need to do, governments. But these bodies can. So exactly the same way in Ireland, if you had an opinion about abortion, whatever your opinion is, you just lost your job as a politician, right? But then that was handled by the people. So the politician said, well, I didn't make the decision, the people did. And this is what we're going to, I'm afraid to say, pushed towards, pushed by circumstances. We are in collapse. This is the context of the conversation we're having tonight. And it's the conversation that should be the context of any conversations anyone having. Because it's going to get a lot worse. And as collapse is becoming much more apparent and palpable and experienced in our own lives, then the need for freeing ourselves from the shackles of an operating system that simply needs upgrading, freeing ourselves from those shackles becomes a bit of a no-brainer. You know, it's Buckminster Fuller. Everyone quotes it. The way to depose a system is create an alternative system that makes that first system obsolete. That's the realm we're working in with the cultural work that I'm doing, you know.
Amazing. And definitely do go and check out that work, especially with the Fate of Britain that just happened the other weekend, which was amazing to see from far. I want to get one final round of quickfire questions in. We've got two great ones here. And yes, do you want to bring in Marjorie and Sean maybe to ask their questions?
Yes, I was just feeling that if I do agree that everybody... I'd like to think that our default mode is compassion, and I've always tried to live by that. But I feel very distressed when I hear about all the horrible messages that people get on social media, completely undeserved, death threats and so on. And also the hate crimes that people just attack others because of their gender or their ethnicity. And that doesn't sound like a default mode of compassion. How do you explain that, and how do we get over that?
Brilliant. Thank you, Marjorie. Well, hang on, just Amy, we'll bring in Sean. One more question.
Okay, just a deceptively straightforward question, but quite a lot to it. How can we generate a genuine grassroots demand and popular support for a citizens' assembly on electoral and democratic reform issues, and specifically on the adoption of an agreed system of proportional representation for elections to the House of Commons?
Brilliant. Very, very on all, ticking all the conscious boxes there, Sean. Not, I didn't plan it. I promise he's not a plan. He just, Sean, you know, you're enlightened. Brilliant. Thank you, folks. So, James, why don't we come to you first and then Jamie? And if you could try to be quick fire, that would be really helpful. Thank you.
I think the problem is with the, I'll go to Sean's question. I think the problem is that, like, well, firstly, even if say we get a Labour government, they did commit to doing a citizens assembly on that, where is the guarantee that they'd implement that? You know, like, and then the second thing I'd say is there's so many countries, and this links the two questions, there's so many countries in Europe, like the vast majority of them have PR, and unfortunately the social relations that Marjorie outlined are just as prevalent in all those other countries, if not more. So that's not to say that PR isn't a really important part of the puzzle, but I also don't know that it's sufficient to deal with the problem that we're in, the massive democratic deficit that we're in, basically. And so I genuinely believe that the best way to popularize and like get support for citizens' assemblies in general is campaign to replace the House of Lords with the House of Citizens. Basically because nobody likes the House of Lords, doesn't matter who they are, nobody thinks it should stay as the same, but nobody knows what to replace it with. Right? So there's a real opportunity there. So it's a way to unify people behind it. But then if we were able to secure that, then that would be a way of the people holding politicians to account to actually implement their promises, which is, to be honest, the main thing I think will be going in people's minds when they go to the polls in, you know, October or November is, does any of this matter? Because will they do any of the things that they've promised to do anyway? And until we sort out this problem of accountability, you know, I'm not like, yes, it's great that we get to choose, but then if they don't do what they say, is it really any choice? And is it any kind of choice, basically? And so then, on the first question, I think that basically those things are a result of divide and rule, which is like a strategy that's as old as the hills. Is that a phrase? Yeah. I don't know. I'm getting old as the hills, something like that. You know, like basically, I believe that these divisions have been strategically stoked between us, and in order to divide our shared interests. And like Jamie mentioned, Occupy before. I think while there are obviously big differences between people who, you know, between us, like ultimately we are the 99%, and the 99% is consistently shut out of decisions that affect their lives, and the 1% disproportionately make the decisions. And as long as that continues, we're screwed, basically. And one of the ways that the 1% maintain that is to get us to fight each other, basically. And so community organizing, citizens assemblies, you know, these sorts of things are ways of building different ways of relating to each other and understanding our shared interests. You know, I'll give one last example and then I'll shut up, I promise. Is I always go back to when the famous example of the Black Panthers getting together with the Young Patriots in Chicago, who were still using the Confederate flag as their symbol, but they realized that they had a shared interest around basically getting screwed over and like in terms of economic justice, right? And so they worked together on that, they struggled together. And through that process, they stopped using the Confederate flag as their symbol because they understood how racism was constructed in order to divide them, right? And that it wasn't okay. So it's a process of working this stuff out together where you begin to rekindle like love and compassion and seeing other people. And that's exactly what this is about, basically. It's brilliant. Part of that broader project of transforming our social relations.
Thank you, James. Finally, Jamie, I'm very sorry, but you have 1 minute. But if anybody can do it 1 minute, you can.
Thanks so much for this last question, Marjorie. I think it's really important. I can't guess your age, but I'm of a generation where when I die, my generation dies, there'll be nobody who remembers life before digital technology. It's had a profound impact on us. And what James is saying is right. It's a very powerful machinery to divide people. But one of the fascinating things about citizens' assemblies is it's an anti-polarization machine. And there are endless stories of people who start at loggerheads with hate. And by listening to each other, it almost always ends with them crying and saying, I'm sorry I got you so wrong. And so that's not a good representation of us, that social media. But when we're in the same room, well-facilitated conversations, listening, then you remember our humanity is restored. Thanks for asking that. It's a really important question.
Yeah.
And a great Francis, this is bloody marvellous. Thank you.
And bloody complicated, but also bloody marvellous. We don't say that enough, to be honest. Thank you so much, both of you. Just to add on to what you were saying there, Jamie, like, and to what you were saying, James, I think we talk about citizen assemblies being democracy under good conditions, right? And everybody has the potential to, and it's a little bit sort of better range of our nature stuff. It's like, you know, all of us can be activated by fear, by anger, by dread, all of these things, but also for all of us can be acted by kind of, you know, faith and optimism and a sense of buoyancy and a sense of trust. Like, all of those things can activate us because we're all human. And so the question is, how do you create the right circumstances for people to activate those other things within them and grow those things within them? And to me, it's a lot about confidence. It's people about having confidence in each other and in themselves a bit. You know, often people just never even asked to solve difficult problems. And when they are asked, they do a great job. And then they think, well, hang on, you know, the kind of where the people we've been waiting for stuff, which is a bit of a cliche, but I think citizen assemblies is one of the best places you can see that actually happening and see people actually grow in real time over a few weeks, their confidence and their sense of capacity, which is, to me, the one of the most brilliant things to see. And people getting to be their own selves, not this very sort of tight, buttoned up version that they think that they maybe have to be in politics, right? And this is something I feel for my politicians as friends as well. I wish they could go and spend some time in certain assemblies and be themselves a bit more, because if they could bring them more selves to the conversation, then they would realise that they actually have a lot in them as well that they could let out that would be helpful to this moment. So I want to say a huge thank you to Jamie Kelsey Fry and James Robertson, two absolute titans of the democracy movement, as has been obvious here tonight from how rich and deep our conversation was. And it's just so great to get such brilliant communicators on the podcast. I really appreciate everything that you're both doing at all levels, but also your ability to kind of make this imaginative and lively and fun is a big part of how we're going to get more people energized and infected with, you know, the citizen assembly and participatory democracy spirit. So please do go check out the work of Sortition Foundation on the House of Citizens and the Global Assembly. And also, so go ahead, Jamie.
One world or none dot world.
One world or one dot world.
One world or none dot
or none. Not one. Yeah, you've done it. We'll just stick it in the chat. It's the easiest thing to do. And huge thank you to you both. Thank you to everybody who asked questions, everyone who was on air tonight. Huge thanks. I'm sorry that we're slightly overran, which is not normal for us, but just this conversation spilled over into wonderful things. Next time on It's Bloody Complicated, we're talking all things Scotland. There'll be a Scotland focus in 2 weeks' time. What is happening in Scottish politics? What does that mean for the sorts of issues that Compass cares about? What does that mean for some of our Scottish members? I'm really excited for that conversation. Going to be helped and facilitated also by our amazing team, several of whom are actually Scottish. Two of our team of eight are. And I was born in Scotland, so I'm just going to play that card right now. So do join in for that. I think it'll be a really fascinating evening. And yeah, very much thanks to Peter, who did the tech tonight, which was a little bit more complicated than it might have looked. A little bit of behind the scenes stuff there. And a huge thanks to everyone who stayed on to the last minute. I think we'll call it a wrap there. Huge thanks to Jamie and James. Go off, be merry, enjoy your Tuesday evenings, and hope to see you back again on It's Bloody Complicated.
If you like what you heard today and want to be part of building a much more equal, democratic and sustainable future, then visit us at compassonline.org.uk/podcast. Plus, you'll be able to join us live on future calls like this one. You can tweet Compass Office or email francis@compassonline.org.uk. If you enjoyed this week's episode, please give us a rating. It will help us reach more listeners in the future. After all, it's only fair they know it's bloody complicated too.